From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
The concealed carry license allows an individual to carry a loaded or unloaded handgun concealed from public view. I'm pleased to say that the department has worked diligently to implement a concealed carry licensing program as required by the Act.
Today you saw the electronic version of submission for applications, and it is probably the best way to go. We are in development of a paper, but with paper applications, you have human error that caused us problems in the FOID system, and that has been, that's why we would like to see people do these online.
Well, I think there's some apprehension out in the law enforcement community, really based upon the fact that they don't know how this will all roll out, and they're worried about every one of their normal encounters, whether it be a domestic disturbance call, a traffic stop, now potentially having additional weapons.
The subject there, concealed carry of weapons. The voices included Illinois State Police Colonel Mark Maton and Democratic State Representative Frank Martino of Spring Valley. They were speaking at a news briefing recently outlining the unveiling of the application process, which opens this weekend online for people who would like to apply to have concealed carry permits in Illinois. We'll discuss concealed carry a bit later on in the show. We'll also be talking about pensions and a quick look back at 2013 as well. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Our panel on the show this week, Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, WUIS News Director Sean Crawford, at our State House Bureau, Brian Mackey, State House Reporter for WUIS, Illinois Public Radio, and our guest today, Mike Riopel, the political editor for the Daily Herald in Arlington Heights. And welcome to our show today, Mike. Well, pension lawsuits have started coming out and being filed. We've had filings in Cook County and in Sangamon County, and before the year's end, we had the first filing. Brian Mackey, why don't you bring us up to date on who has all filed a lawsuit so far against the new pension law?
So the one we had last week that you mentioned last year was from a group of retired teachers and retired school administrators. The one we saw this week was from two groups representing about 16,000 retired state employees. That's three total lawsuits we've had so far. The big one we're still waiting for, of course, is going to be filed by the We Are One Coalition, which is a lot of the big labor unions that represent both current employees and retirees of state government.
Why are we seeing, Brian, these lawsuits filed from different folks?
That's a really good question, because I was scratching my head a little bit about, you know, some of these groups I had hardly heard of. We don't hear a lot from on a day-to-day basis, unlike the unions, which are big presences, you know, in the Capitol, lobbying all the time as political contributors. These groups are a lot smaller. But their contention is that the labor unions are looking out primarily for current employees, and they represent retirees, and a lot of whom aren't in labor unions. And they, you know, I think their idea is we want to make sure that we have a seat at the table. So if there is, you know, ever any sort of settlement or negotiation or anything like that, I think that they want to make sure that their interests are represented, which, you know, if you're a current retiree, somebody who's, you know, put in your 35 years of service to the state, as one of the litigants who filed this week did, you have a different perspective maybe than somebody who's an AFSCME member, a prison guard or something, who's only worked 5 or 10 years and still has a long career ahead of you and is worried both about your current earnings as well as your pension.
The broad claim, Mike Riopel, I assume, or I presume, is that this would constitute a diminishing of benefits and therefore would be unconstitutional under the state constitution. Is that correct?
That's right, Bill. And you know, the Illinois Constitution has very plain language about that you just referenced, that pensions can't be diminished or impaired, and that's what the battle will be over. Will there be some legal questions that maybe we don't anticipate? Probably. But at the end of the day, it's about that Constitution, about that language, about whether or not lawmakers can make this move based on the Constitution they adopted in 1970.
I always feel a little self-conscious talking about the Constitutional Convention and what went into it when Charlie's around, because he was there and he could probably speak to this with his firsthand knowledge. But, you know, at least as far as the arguments that the lawyers were making in one of the cases yesterday, they pointed out that, hey, guess what? In 1970, the pensions were very underfunded back then as well. And that, you know, the people who were at the Constitutional Convention knew what they were doing when they put this clause in, and it was just to prevent this exact sort of thing. So I don't know if that strikes you as accurate, Charlie.
Oh, it certainly does. As a matter of fact, there was correspondence at the time between some senior lawmakers on an old panel called the Pension Law Study Commission, and the chief sponsor, the delegate who sponsored the pension protection provision. And the lawmakers, in essence, were saying, look, if you put this in the Constitution, we won't be able to change the benefits in the future should we need to. And the delegate's response was, yeah, that's the whole point. So it was pretty clear what was in the mind of the General Assembly. And, Brian, as you mentioned, the pensions were no better funded back then than they are today. And as a matter of fact, some of the research that Eric Medeer, Senate President John Cullerton's chief legal counsel, did on this issue showed a document from, I believe it was 1946, talking about how severely underfunded the pension systems were, and they weren't funded any better back then than they are now. The state has had a long history for generations of not contributing the amount of money it should have, which is why we're in the situation we are today.
One of my favorite parallels in this whole thing is there's a report from before, well before I think the Constitutional Convention, that describes what Charlie's talking about, and we've all heard about Governor Quinn talking about Squeezy the Pension Python, this cartoon snake trying to illustrate how bad things have gotten. This report at the time describes a tornado sucking up money out of the state budget. And it's all, you know, there was another cartoon even decades ago trying to explain this thing.
Pick your metaphor.
Yeah.
That was the perfect storm of its day.
That's right.
Apparently. Charlie Wheeler, we see retirees filing separate suits. Is there any advantage? Is there something they'll get by filing a suit, some different legal argument that could possibly be made on this kind of issue that won't be covered, but when the unions step in and with presumably a lot more legal money behind them to file theirs?
Well, one of the issues that the people who are pushing this benefit cuts are going to argue makes it constitutional is a legal concept called consideration. In other words, we're taking away your benefits, but we're giving you something in return. And the two main things in return are you'll have to contribute less for your pension going forward, and we're going to give you the ability to come in and sue to make the state put the money into the systems the way it should. Now, if you're retired, having someone say you won't have to pay any more out of your salary really doesn't apply to you because you're no longer contributing since you are no longer an active member. And so that doesn't fit your circumstance at all. And the idea of being able to come in and go to court and argue the legislature has to do it, there have been similar suits filed in the past, and the Supreme Court in essence has said the legislature has to pay the benefits, but it doesn't have to set the money aside. And so I think there's different interests. As Brian said, there's the interests are different. And a lot of the people who are promoting taking away the benefits like to cast this in terms of, oh, it's those greedy public employee unions. And they don't really – they're just looking out for themselves. They don't care about the state. Well, a lot of people in the state – in the retired state employees lawsuit were not union members during their tenure. Not everybody who works for the state belongs to a union.
Including, we should probably say, those of us on this panel, except for Mike Riopel, who are university employees, but we're not union members. And so, yeah, I mean, that's not necessarily there are plenty of people, as Charlie was saying, who work in state government who are not unionized.
Another issue related to the matter of pensions was a year-end report that came out this week from the Auditor General, Brian.
Yeah, basically, this was a sort of the state actuary's report. Actuary is a word that kind of makes people's eyes glaze over, but bear with me for a second. Basically, this outside actuary is supposed to be kind of a watchdog on what the in-house actuaries for the pension systems are doing. So there were a couple of warnings in this report. In one, the actuary warns that officials are being too optimistic in how much money they expect the pension systems to be able to make from their investments. They're sort of expecting too high a rate of return. And it also says that the systems need to more thoroughly explain some of their losses. The teachers' retirement system had $254 million in losses in a recent year, and it felt that there were inadequate explanations for some of these things. And one of the other highlight key points of this is something that Charlie has been talking about for a long time. Listeners to the show will know is that, you know, people talk about the ballooning cost of pension payments, but it turns out next year it's not actually the amount we have to pay. It's a big dollar amount, but it's not going to increase that much over the previous year.
About $100 million, which does seem like a lot of money, but in comparison,
well, it's, you know, yeah, $100 million here, $100 million there. Pretty soon you're talking real money.
But on the other hand, the last couple of years, 2 years ago, the increase was in the area of $900 million, and last year it was in the area of $1 billion. So under this long-term funding plan adopted in 1995, there was a ramp-up in terms of the state's contribution, and we've finally gotten over the hump. And now for the next several years, the increase is going to be in the neighborhood of $100, $200 million. And, yeah, that's an awful lot of money. But on the other hand, it's not like annual increases of $1 billion or more.
And also that pension system criticism on how much money they can make from their investments, that's been out there for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, you know, some people would tell you, and some critics in the legislature would tell you, that that was one of the reasons the pension systems are in the shape they're in, is that they have overestimated earnings for so long and not met those estimates. Now, a few years back, they changed some rules that allowed the pension systems to make some more what you might call investments where they that were not quite as safe, possibly. And what happened then was, sure, you saw some increases in good years with stocks and bonds, but you also saw some really negative years as well. So I think there's some real question there as far as the you know, how the pension systems go about determining and estimating what they're going to be able to make.
But on the other hand, the historic record for the teachers' retirement system, for example, is that I think it's over the last 30 years, the average rate of return has been higher than what their assumptions are. And I know there are people who want to strip away public employee benefits who cite all these different reasons. The benefits are too high. The systems don't handle their investments properly. The bottom line is, and the data is indisputable, the reason the pension systems are in the problem that they're in is because the employer, namely the state of Illinois, has not contributed as much as it should have. And it hasn't been doing it for 60 or more years. And that's why the systems are so underfunded, as opposed to the Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund, which covers basically most city workers, most county workers, aside from police and fire. It's funded at about 85% of its required liabilities. And the reason is because the local governments aren't allowed to short payments or skip payments. Every year they have to put aside the money that's required actuarially to keep the fund in good shape.
You're listening to State Week in Review. Just ahead, we'll talk about those concealed carry applications, which people can start processing on Sunday.
Support for State Week in Review comes from the Illinois State Bar Association, whose activities include proposing and shaping legislation, educating the public, and supporting the courts and the rule of law. Information at IllinoisLawyerFinder.com.
Our panel on State Week, Charlie Wheeler, Sean Crawford, Brian Mackey, and the Daily Herald's Mike Riopel. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Well, Illinois this past year became the 50th state in the union to allow some form of concealed carry of weapons. And now on this Sunday, this weekend, people can begin applying online for the concealed carry applications. They unveiled kind of what was needed, authorities did recently. Mike and Brian, can you bring us up to speed there?
Yeah, so basically there are a number of requirements. You have to have, I believe it's 16 hours of training. You have to have your fingerprints done digitally. There are a lot of different steps you have to take, but people have been very eager for this to happen. They already opened up. They've tried to do – you know, we heard a lot about with the federal healthcare website, you know, problems and website crashes when a lot of people glom onto something like that. So the state police, I think they kind of had that in the back of their minds, and they were saying that they had done different types of tests on this website. They let their concealed carry instructors get in there and test the system out, and they already had other people who they couldn't finish the application process, but they began just kind of on their own finding their way to this website and beginning the, you know, beginning to take the steps that they'd need to take in order to do this. It'll still be, you know, it'll take them a little time to process these applications, but it could be within a few weeks when, you know, the state police finally starts handing out these licenses.
Yeah, and instruction has already been happening, and a lot, one thing instructors talk about is how they have to be teaching people who are going to get these licenses, these permits, very soon, where you can carry and where you can't. That's going to be the main place where people who want to carry legally are going to have to stay out of trouble. You can't carry on a playground, but there are many other places you can carry. And already there's people talking about, you know, how that's going to change. You know, how might lawmakers try and change that law in different ways this year and change the rules they just made? So even as people are just now getting permits, who knows what might change over the course of the year.
And we're already seeing on the Capitol complex, for example, they posted signs that, you know, have the bar sinister, the red circle with a line through it and a handgun. I've seen them at the University of Illinois, where WUIS is located, and I've even seen it on a daycare building in town here. So they are putting up these, you know, businesses and places are putting up these signs if they want to indicate no firearms on their premises.
The one I saw was about knee high, and I don't usually look at that level to see what is permitted or not permitted. Now, I have a question, and I don't want to pin you down, but I've done it by asking the question. Can an individual establishment decide on its own whether it will allow for someone to enter with a gun or not?
Yeah, among the many exceptions that we've talked about, there's a line that says that a property owner can prohibit carrying of guns on his property. So an individual business can do that. Starbucks, for example, got created a lot of controversy maybe a couple months ago when they kind of came out nationally and said they didn't want to do this anywhere. So that might become controversial, various stance businesses take.
You can imagine it being kind of like, does a business choose to put up a sign that says season's greetings or Merry Christmas or Happy Holiday? You know, this is like, oh, it's almost a political stance, right? If you're going to say, oh, you can imagine the locally owned coffee shop by the aging hippie that has the Obama poster and the peace signs on the wall, would expect that. But I mean, you could have a more innocuous business that maybe makes this decision and ends up irritating a lot of its customers and making a lot of its other customers happy. So
go ahead.
No, that's all I was just saying. Okay. You can see the potential.
It occurs to me one of the difficulties a business owner might have is if you do allow concealed firearms on, you know, somebody carrying to come into your establishment and something happens, is there any liability for you as the business owner?
I'm not a lawyer, but I don't believe that there is. I mean, we talked to businesses for the paper a couple weeks ago about, it's not the same, but the new cell phone law where you can't talk on the phone while driving. And if a company provides you with a cell phone, are they liable for if you mess up while you're, you know, driving illegally? And one piece of advice that a chamber vice president gave was, no matter what you end up doing, have a written policy for it. Have it written down, and I'm sure that would apply here. You'd probably want to write down what your policy is somewhere.
Well, Charlie, I think as you've said in the past in other contexts, anybody can be sued for anything. I'm not sure if there's specifically like a safe harbor provision in this law or something like that. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, because as I say, that is something that might go through a business owner's mind in determining whether or not to put up one of those signs prohibiting firearms on his property.
Now, another question. The audio we had at the beginning of the show, one of the things is they were saying how much quicker and more effective this electronic rollout will be. And then you mentioned the federal health care law. We could also look at the problems they've had with the CTA Ventra situation in Chicago. But there is the opportunity at some point for paper applications. When is that?
I think it's coming later this year. I want to say maybe June was the date I saw. But, you know, people really don't, even if you don't have a computer, you're not that internet savvy, there are a number of places that have sort of taken it upon themselves to offer help. So the sheriff's office here in Sangamon County in Springfield has offered to let people use a computer there to file these applications and to help them with it. I've seen at least one state representative from downstate offer, you know, say he'll open up his office to let people come in and help them register for this problem. So I'm guessing that the number of people who really want to concealed carry, you know, who would have to wait until they formally begin accepting paper applications is going to be a pretty small number of people.
Another thing in Illinois politics, Bruce Rauner, one of the four Republican candidates for governor, who has led the way with funding thus far, was out with a release touting his final quarter of the year fundraising, about $4 million, including $1 million of his own. So far, he is showing the money strength. Is that scaring others away?
I haven't seen anyone be scared away yet. It's still pretty early in this process. We haven't had any debates yet. But, I mean, he is been pretty successful with locking up some of the big money people in this race. And so I think that as – I mean, he is flashing a lot of cash. I can imagine if he starts buying up airtime, he could almost corner the market on TV ads. Now, there's a lot of TV markets in Illinois that can be pretty challenging to do. But, you know, he is certainly establishing himself on the financial side of things.
And one of the benefits of being on TV so often, so early, is that you get to – define yourself in public before your opponents have the money and time and voice on TV to define you. So he can spend a lot of time getting his name and the message he wants into people's minds before the candidates with less money have a chance to do that for themselves or go on the attack against him.
Yeah, even if he is scaring some of those other candidates, the question is, will we know? Because we don't hear from them. We can't – they're not going to get the same type of publicity he's getting. And I think the only thing I've seen regarding this money is the attack that some of them have been making, saying he's trying to buy the election. That's their response to it. I don't know if that's going to fly in a primary.
It is certainly one that somebody uses when they don't have as much money right. as the other person. And right now, a lot of those appear to be touting his support for charter schools and still keeping the statements rather broad, but just saying he doesn't think children should have to attend failing schools.
Yeah, his whole campaign message has been very broad. It's been very difficult to pin him down on specifics. Well, we've hardly seen him here in Springfield. But even, you know, when people have managed to get him on the phone, he says, well, I'm just focused on my message today, and often does not want to get into the nitty gritty of policy questions.
Take a moment and do something we don't usually do towards the end of the show. But as a final nod to 2013, we're going to end this week with some of the state legislative highlights over the past year. The actual sound from the floor and elsewhere. Brian Mackey went through the audio archives and produced this.
This is no small issue. This is a choice about whether we will make the tough decisions necessary to balance our budget by reforming our public pension systems.
There will be changes here, but this bill is a well thought out, well balanced bill.
There's only one way to describe that kind of blatant taking of one's life savings. We call it theft.
Every legislator on this floor has a different opinion when it comes to concealed carry policy.
There is no compelling evidence, despite what gun advocates say, to show that more guns makes people safer.
This is a fundamental, constitutionally protected civil right. The right to self-defense, the right to own a firearm. It's not a privilege to be meted out by bureaucratic, you know, people on an eeny, meeny, miny, mo.
The choice is this: fracking in Illinois with no regulation, or fracking in Illinois with the tightest, most stringent regulations possible.
Schools can only do so much, quote, more with less.
I learned that the Senate Democrats and the House Democrats struck a deal on the budget, not from our members that usually participate. I learned it on public radio. Isn't that a travesty?
So far, there's no plan whatsoever that's discernible for this tax increase to go away.
Wake up! You guys have lost the tax argument. That's why you have 19 and we have 40.
I absolutely believe that I could go to my doctor and go through my history of medical conditions and I could get medical marijuana under your bill. I believe I could.
Do you have any of those medical conditions today?
I believe I do.
Then maybe you need the product, sir.
I'm doing well without it.
There's a process that I went through in terms of evaluating how I could best continue to serve the people of the state of Illinois. Obviously, that involved private conversations that I will not be going through with you publicly.
I don't believe that if the governor is renominated by the Democratic Party, he will win a general election. He barely won against a very flawed candidate 4 years ago.
I was given a 9% chance of winning in the general election, and I won. And Brady's still looking for his gym shoes.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here today with running shoes on and game on for the Republican Party.
I know that going into communities of diversity is imperative for us as Republicans to earn the right to govern.
I know how to govern a Democrat legislature to get it to do things, to live within its means.
I love to fight. I love to win. I've been a leader at everything I've touched throughout my career, both in business and in our civic leadership in our community.
In Illinois, we tried civil unions, and that separate status has time and time again proved to fall short.
We are a family that is treated differently under the eyes of the law. We are a family that does not have the same protections that your family has.
I've had three judges in my district call up and say, David, there is not a facility in your district that's going to perform me ceremonies. They're going to call me. Where's my religious individual freedoms?
I don't get out to the movies very often, and I just watched Lincoln. And for the love of God, I feel like I'm sitting in 1865.
Some of the sounds of 2013 in Illinois politics and government. That's our time for this edition of State Week. Thanks to our guest, Mike Riopel of the Daily Herald. You can get a podcast of this show by going to WUIS.org, or if using a desktop or laptop, find it on iTunes by searching for State Week in Review. Production assistance for our program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.